You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingawa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Jasmine. E wha akene coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the results of the Ipsos survey, the removal of the requirement for school boards to give effect to the treaty, the petition for a social media ban for under-16s, and the government banning puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. For International Desk, I spoke to Vera Paki, Youth Engagement Coordinator at Save the Children New Zealand, about her experience on the ground at COP30 in Brazil. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about Plan Change 120 and Tāmaki hosting the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Education this week. I also talked to Deputy Secretary of Workers First Union, Anita Rosentrader, about the four New Zealanders that have won a four-year legal battle against Uber.
Hea ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or wae mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawe e wariwari iahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. E pakehere rokiroki maronga i te pae tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho mi haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The Ipsos New Zealand survey has shown Labour is the most trusted political party for 8 of the top 10 most important issues to voters. These include issues like cost of living, healthcare, and the economy. The only issues in the top 10 Labour was not the most trusted party for are law and order, which is National, and climate change, which is the Green Party. The government has amended the Education and Training Act to remove the requirement for school boards to give effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. A petition calling for a minimum age of 16 to access social media has been handed over to Parliament. The petition had 44,000 signatures, and the government is halting prescriptions of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria while continuing to allow them for cisgender young people. This decision goes against expert advice, with Dr. Elizabeth McAlria, GP specialist in gender-affirming care and PATHA vice president, stating, "The ban will lead to a deterioration in mental health, increased risk of suicidality, and increased dysphoria in gender-diverse children and young people, and will put them at a higher risk of experiencing marginalisation and discrimination." For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking if he could speak to what the results of the Ipsos survey mean for Labour.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that New Zealanders recognise that Christopher Luxon promised to fix the economy and the cost of living. That's the thing that people are feeling the most hard done by at the moment, and he simply hasn't done that. He's made it worse.
Why do you think cost of living and inflation is the top issue for New Zealanders?
Well, it's the thing that everyone deals with on a daily. When we go to the supermarket and butter's up, cheese is up, a loaf of bread, you know, becomes too expensive. That's not the New Zealand that we expect to live in. At the very least, people expect to be able to buy affordable food, you know, when things are a bit tight, but that's not the case here. And things are really going backwards for them, and New Zealanders feel that.
What do you think Labor has to do to be the leading party on the issue of law and order?
Well, I think it's important that we continue to front up to the challenges that are in front of us. But we've always said that we need to deal with the root cause behind law and order. For me personally, that comes back to ensuring that every young person grows up with the right opportunities, with an education, with the right pathways and care to be able to build a good life for themselves. But when they do go on the wrong pathway, that they can go into alternative rehabilitation programs to get them back on the right pathway and to, you know, set themselves up for a good and meaningful life.
Overall, do you think these results show that Labor has a good chance in the election next year?
They certainly look positive. When I am out and about in my community, you know, you measure that by how many people want to engage with you around policy, want to talk about the government, the issues of the day. But certainly there's a long way to go, 12 months-ish. We'll see in the new year when the Prime Minister announces the election. There's a long way for us to go, and we've got to ensure that we're focused on what Labor brings to the future of Aotearoa New Zealand and give something for people to vote for. I'm really pleased with the policy announcements we've done to date. I think the most popular in my electorate is the three free GP visits, which we're able to achieve through a capital gains tax.
And what is your response to the government's plan to remove the requirement for school boards to give effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
I've been very vocal on this one. I think it's an atrocity that the government would prioritise this over learners' needs. No Board of Trustees in New Zealand has said that this is getting in the way of them focusing on raising achievement for learners. This is just another government initiative to double down on Te Tiriti, to kick Māori, and to really make sure that they're staying relevant for all the wrong reasons. It demonstrates a lack of leadership from Minister Stanford and Christopher Luxon. This is not the New Zealand that the average person wants. We want one that is about unity and kotahitanga.
Are you optimistic about the fact that many schools have pushed back against this removal of Te Tiriti?
When schools like mine on the North Shore are all actively writing their letters, posting them to community pages and sending them to Minister Stanford, you know that you've really hit a nerve in the education sector. The sector is sick and tired of being told what to do from this government, decisions being made without any evidence. I questioned Minister Stanford in the committee of the whole House to ask her how she expects to achieve equity of learning without Te Tiriti o Waitangi at the centre of what they do. Fundamentally, I think that is important, the equity and addressing the disparities of learning is a pathway through Te Tiriti, and that's what our schools stand for too.
Given everything happening in the education space at the moment, how does this proposed change fit into the many other changes the government has made to the education system?
Well, the removal of Te Tiriti is consistent with government position since they arrived 2 years ago. But the point here is that Minister Stanford dropped it 1 hour before the Committee of the Whole House. She could have done that through a select committee process where the public and schools and parents could have been able to respond to that. Instead, she sneakily put it out there in a part of the legislative process where the public cannot participate, and that's not acceptable.
How many of these changes, particularly relating to Te Tiriti and schools, will Labor reverse if elected next year?
Well, we are going through our policy process at the moment. Next week is our annual conference, which is the end part of our policy process. There's a number of education remits that our members will make decisions on, and that sets us up for next year. Any repeals are included in that process as well. But what I will say is that we have announced that the current one that we debated yesterday, the Education and Training Act on Early Education, we have committed to repealing already.
And are you personally supportive of the petition to ban social media for under-16s?
Well, I've been involved in the inquiry through our select committee. I think there's a number of views in that. It acknowledges that there's some real risks that sort of sit behind young people accessing content online and being accessed by people that we don't want to be in the lives of people that are under 16. My concern and issue that I'll continue to navigate is that rainbow communities, rainbow young people in particular, commonly go online to find a community that represents them. We need to ensure that that is retained in some way, and so that's what I'll be pushing for, how we achieve that within the proposed ban.
Can you explain why Labor is supporting a bill on this issue through first reading, but not committing to supporting it any further?
Well, we think that there's a lot of discussions, particularly around resources, on how we might achieve that. In principle, it sounds like the right thing to do, but we want to open that up to go into public submissions for parents, for young people to have their say. We want to hear from experts, and then that will inform our decision moving into the second reading and onto the third.
And you've mentioned the impact for rainbow communities. Do you think it's important that young people are included in this conversation?
Absolutely. Young people need to be at the centre of this conversation. You know, I've always committed to ensuring that young people are able to identify as who they choose to be. Largely, that can be informed and influenced online. With that, you know, we need to be responsible around the information that young people can access. But, you know, I acknowledge that at my age, the things that I'm looking at compared to the things that they're looking at are quite different, and that's exactly why I want to hear from them.
And I want to finish by asking about puberty blockers. What is your response to the government blocking young people with gender dysphoria from being able to access puberty blockers?
Firstly, I want to just acknowledge how hard this will hit for the rainbow community. For rainbow young people and their whānau. It's an unnecessary decision, and rather than looking at the evidence and making a decision on that, the national government has made a political decision based on their ideological views and the influence from New Zealand First. This is not the way that we want the health system to operate. We want a health system that supports people, that gives them the dignity that they deserve. So I think it's an incredibly sad day for Aotearoa.
Are you concerned about the negative mental health consequences this could cause?
I've called for the government to respond to this issue immediately. I think the ban is one thing, but I'm asking them to support young people and their families now through pastoral support, through mental health care, that we just can't walk away from people that are needing some sort of support. So the ball is in their court to respond to that, and I hope they do so.
You've mentioned that this is a politically motivated decision. Is this decision a result of the same kind of harmful anti-trans moral panic we've seen out of the US and the UK recently?
Well, it certainly looks like it, and we've seen that from Winston Peters. We saw that the report that came out, instead of being left with the Ministry of Health and the Minister to make the decision, that went to Simeon Brown, and a decision was made collectively at Cabinet. That's really unheard of, actually, and so it shows the level of politics that has played out in this decision, and it's been incredibly unfortunate.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on the results of the Ipsos survey, the removal of the requirement for school boards to give effect to the treaty, the petition for a social media ban for under-16s, and the government banning puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council has unveiled their long-term housing development proposition in the form of Plan Change 120, which is now open for public submissions until December 19. Key focuses include intensifying housing density in high infrastructure areas. This week, Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei also welcomed the world's largest Indigenous education conference to Tāmaki Makaurau, bringing over 3,800 visitors. Accompanying the conference is Te Ao Pūtahi, a free public festival showcasing Indigenous artistry that is happening in Aotea Square until 7pm tonight. This morning, I spoke to Julie Ferry about both of these topics. Kia ora, Julie. Looking at Plan Change 120, what role does it play in Auckland's housing future?
Basically, Plan Change 120 is the new rule book that will apply to housing in Auckland. It applies to other things too, but it's primarily about housing. And what it will lay out is what you can build and where you can build it, what the rules are that apply basically to each piece of residential land, where there is residential land, where there's business land, that kind of stuff. So it is a really big deal, and it is mapping out the future of what housing in our city looks like. But one thing to know is that none of that happens overnight, and we've still got another probably 18 months of process to go through before it's signed off. And even when it does, it's about what people are allowed to do with the land, not what they have to do with the land. And so what we'll see is it unfolding over the next 30 years. We won't see the sudden change in the landscape and cityscape that we all know.
There are some concerns from the public about pacing infrastructure growth with housing intensification as these things may change. And as you say, it is a longer term process as well. How does council seek to balance these?
So one of the big things is that the areas that have more housing proposed for them are also the areas where we know that we have the infrastructure capacity. So there has in the past been more building on the outskirts, and when we build further out from the city centre, that actually requires a lot more infrastructure, and also that infrastructure is more expensive. We have to build new, and we have to build, literally longer pipes, longer roads, right? Whereas what the proposal does for the most part is actually proposes more housing to be where we already know that we have the infrastructure. The big constraint for the central isthmus area, so that sort of city fringe and the inner suburbs, historically, in the last sort of 10, 15 years, the big infrastructure constraint has been public transport. And with the City Rail Link coming online sometime next year, that resolves the public transport infrastructure deficit. We know from Watercare, who do the wastewater and the drinking water, that those areas have enough wastewater and drinking water capacity to add a lot more. We do have some stormwater issues, so that's dealing with flooding, and there are particular parts that are sort of carved out where we know we've got stormwater issues for less intense housing as well. So that's being taken into account. We know from Vector that there's enough electricity. We know that we've got enough of the other utilities that council doesn't control, like fibre and phone connections and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of, we don't really do phone connections anymore, but you know what I mean. The one thing that isn't taken into account is provision for health and education. Those are central government responsibilities, and they react to the housing growth that we put in and predict. So there's a lot of conversations about making sure central government has their part ready for in the health and education space, and that's ongoing. But again, because it will roll out quite slowly over time, there's opportunity to work on that and make sure that those things are ready to go when they need to be, hopefully. But a lot of that does sit with central government.
Earlier this week, Tāmaki hosted the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Education, which is a really awesome thing for us to be able to house as a city. And alongside this, there's also been the Te Ao Pūtahi Festival hosted up in Aotea Square, spotlighting a lot of international cultures. What are your thoughts on Tāmaki hosting this week?
I just think it's magic. I really do. It's been amazing being in the city centre this week and seeing people walk around proudly in clothes that reflect their Indigenous culture from where they've come. And it's been a really interesting mix because we've had a lot of Metallica fans in town as well. And so the Metallica t-shirts and the black jeans and the particular type of hat that I've seen a lot of Metallica bands wearing. It's been a beautiful juxtaposition. And it's been, I think, you know, these kinds of events are just beautiful for Tamaki Makaurau. It's a way for us to honour our Indigenous people ourselves, but also showcase to the world how far we have come in acknowledging tangata whenua, and also challenge us about how far we have still to go. And so I just think it's wonderful. I'm really proud that we've been hosting, and more of this, please, basically, yeah.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on Plan Change 120 for Auckland Housing and the arts and culture happening in Tamaki this week.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts, 5395.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Go Cooler Music is giving away a guitar. Want to win it? Just text Go Cooler to 5395, spelled G-O-K-U-L-A, along with your B-card number and your favorite guitar player or riff, and you'll be in the draw to win a Torquay Legacy guitar. Tune in to Dirtbag Radio Monday, December 1st from 7 to 9pm to hear Rapley draw the winner. Cheers, Go Cooler Music. 378 Broadway, Newmarket.
95BFM Drive Island at the Bear Spot Morningside with Crystal Chen and Joe Captain. Friday, November 28th from 4 to 7pm.
Tunes, pints, and the folks from your fave radio station? What more could you want on a sunny Friday arvo? So cruise down and enjoy some jazzy tunes from the talented Crystal Chin and the prolific Joe Captain.
Drive Island at the Bear Spot Morningside from 4 to 7pm, Friday, November 28th. Thanks to McLeod's and NZ On Air.
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
Oh, beloved woman of liberty!
2 hours of punk, hardcore, goats, doom, metal and thrash. The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show. 11pm to 1am every Sunday night, only on 95BFM.
Critias, you are wise. Tell me, what is Italo Disco?
Surely, Socrates, it is disco-inspired music from Italy. The name proclaims it.
But what of Sally Shapiro and her throwback Italo sound?
Then, Socrates, it's music which draws inspiration from an idiomatically Italian interpretation of disco with synthesizers and slower tempos.
Critias, a problem remains here too.
Socrates.
It makes you sound like a huge wanker.
Embiggen your mind with Plato's Retreat on 95BFM with your hosts Sam, Chris, Anika and Rob. 4 to 7 every Saturday, thanks to Halotau.
Makes me hard in the face, hot blood in my pulsing veins, heavy memories weighing on my brain, hard and heavy in the basement of your parents' place. You used to be so sweet, now you're a firecracker on a crowded street. Couldn't look away even if I wanted, try to walk away but I come back to the start.
People
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk
are go.
This week, COP30, the world's main annual climate summit, has continued in the Amazonian city of Belém, Brazil. The talks have been marked by calls from more than 80 countries to create a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels. This is despite top officials from the United States not being present at the conference and the nation's prevalent anti-climate politics. COP30 also marks a new push from Indigenous voices to be elevated at the summit, with the largest Indigenous participation in any COP in history, an estimated 3,000 people, with 1,000 participating in negotiations. Tens of thousands of people also protested outside COP30 last week in the first large-scale protest at a United Nations climate summit in years. I spoke with Vera Packey, Youth Engagement Coordinator at Save the Children New Zealand, who was on the ground at COP. I started by asking if she could discuss what the atmosphere is like.
Yeah, absolutely. The atmosphere at COP30 is definitely vibrant. It definitely reflects the environment that we're in Brazil. It is loud in a great way. We're having lots of really big conversations. There's lots of music. And I think the running theme is just lots and lots of footsteps, people running from place to place. There's so many eager discussions and conversations and protests to be had on the ground.
What are the key themes that are emerging from this COP?
I mean, broadly, there are always these big talks specifically about climate finance. So what are countries that are in the OECD world doing to mitigate their impacts and to recognize the fact that low-income countries are not delivering the level of impact, but are still receiving the most amount of adverse climate effects, and what it looks like to justly rectify those indiscretions. The discussions that we're participating in that specifically look at child and youth engagement and participation. So we understand that children and young people are disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis, and what does it mean for those rights to be recognized, not only in conversation, but in policy and finance and planning. And then, of course, the backdrop of Indigenous partnerships and Indigenous engagement overall. We have seen protests by the Indigenous people here in Belém that spoke to really show the fact that even though many of us are descending from very faraway lands, the level of engagement with their own local Indigenous people leaves much to be desired. So those are the really big things that I'm seeing from my end.
You've just come from an action led by Save the Children. Can you talk about the purpose of this?
So Save the Children International have come together and pulled our delegations present at COP into an action really focused on children's rights and what it looks like to have children and youth voice integrated into the COP negotiating process. We understand that children and young people have a limited amount of influence and power in this landscape. So what we want to do is really bring their voices and their stories to the forefront of our COP negotiators to ensure that they are not forgotten. We know in the case of New Zealand, even though we have seen in our COP negotiating manual that our negotiators operate from a rights-based framework, that children and young people are not specifically listed as those rights holders. So we really want to make it clear that children and young people are a vulnerable population to be protected, specifically in the climate space.
Can you talk about what it's like to be a young person at COP?
It's a very interesting dichotomy to be a young person at COP. I'm really grateful for the fact that I am a part of the party overflow, so I have access to the blue zone, which is where most of the decision-making practice takes place. But what you recognize is the minute that you're in the blue zone, there are also 40,000 other people in the blue zone, not a lot of young people. And you really recognize that it is a global conversation. Coming from New Zealand, I feel that we are in such a lucky position where we can almost casually engage some of our policy leaders, but coming into this space, you really recognize the weight of some of these conversations and the significance of having those face-to-face interactions. It's really remarkable to meet with other young climate activists from across the world and hearing their stories and what it's like for their communities who are in their own way struggling with frontline climate issues and what they're trying to do to really raise that awareness and engage with their policy influencers. So as a young person, there's a lot to be desired because you walk into the space and you don't see a lot of people that look like you, and you understand that you have a limited amount of power. But in the other hand, whenever you get to connect with other young people who are doing similar work in the space, there is a sense of hope and a sense of urgency. We're all working to make sure that our communities don't just survive, they thrive through this climate crisis. So mixed emotions, but overall it's a really dynamic experience.
How important are the conversations that are currently being had?
The conversations being had are absolutely paramount. We recognize that even though there's much criticism, rightfully so, about the types of conversation and their frequency and their intensity, this is the highest point of climate decision making in the world. They are deeply, deeply important. The fact that you can come here and really raise some of these not only key issues across the pavilions, across these different zones, and hear what the types of bilateral negotiations that are happening at the highest level, the key priorities that are coming from governments at the highest level, and the fact that you can kind of have those ideas of what they deem are important, absolutely critical.
And have you learned anything about how Aotearoa is being perceived at this COP?
Yes, Aotearoa always has this really interesting reputation internationally. It's always a privilege to connect with our Indigenous communities across the world. So at this COP, we have our Indigenous Peoples Pavilion, and I want to take a moment to really highlight the work of Te Kahu Kōkere, which is the Rangatahi Māori delegation who were here the week before us as a part of the National Indigenous Chairs Forum. And their work in that space has been absolutely remarkable. And that kind of continues outwards into the Moana Blue Pacific Pavilion and then a little bit into the Australia Pavilion. There is a recognition of the fact that our people are doing immaculate work, that our Indigenous people are leading innovation, and we were really lucky to host the UN Adaptation Futures Conference in Christchurch in October. So already there is this understanding in New Zealand being a leader of having the capacity to really innovate in this space, which I think kind of leads on to some of the frustrations that we're seeing at a national level at the legislation changes that we are experiencing over the past couple of weeks. Because we understand that we have this huge capacity for growth and innovation, and that's understood globally, and we are really respected for that, but it's not resonating at a policy level. So it is always warm. We always get a really lovely and warm reception when people see Aotearoa New Zealand, but I think they also want more for us as well, like we do.
Is there anything else you would want people to know, particularly young people who might be listening, about COP?
Yeah, COP is a amazing, wonderful experience, but you don't need to be at COP to make a meaningful difference. This is one part of the puzzle when it comes to climate activism and advocacy, but everything that we do, especially at a local level, plays into all of the work that happens here. It's not just being in Belém, Brazil that makes that work worth it. What we do in our schools, on marae, with our whānau, our friends, in university spaces, in your workplaces, all of those different areas of work matter deeply to the work that we're doing to alleviate the climate crisis. Another thing that I would say is that you are incredibly qualified as young people to speak on your own experience. Like I said earlier, children and young people are disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis, even more so if you are located in the South Pacific. Anything you have to say about that lived experience is incredibly valid, exists without any additional qualification, and deserves to be heard. So don't feel as though that you have to get 10,000 different degrees before you can speak on your experience here. What you have to say matters right now.
That was Vera Packey, Youth Engagement Coordinator at Save the Children New Zealand, on her experience on the ground at COP30 in Brazil.
International Desk on 95BFM.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is The Sofa from Wolf Alice.
Hope I can accept the wild thing in me. Hope nobody comes to tame her. She can be free. is in my behavior and what I want to be. Just let me lie here and suffer and put the beep on TV. California, where I thought I might clean the slate. Feels a little like I'm stuck in Seven Sisters, love, London, or England. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's hard. I'll be okay. I feel kinda lucky right now, and I'm not ashamed to say I can be happy, I can be sad, I can be a witch.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The Supreme Court has made a final ruling on the four-year-long court battle between four Kiwi Uber drivers and the Uber Corporation earlier this week. The case signals a huge win for acknowledging employment rights for drivers amidst the exploitative pitfalls of contractor classifications. The result coincides with the current employment relations bill that has passed its first reading in Parliament, a piece of legislation that would only allow selected workers access to the court or authority to seek declaration of their employment status and secure any minimum rights. The bill was drafted in part by Uber. I spoke to Anita Rosentrader, Deputy Secretary of Workers First Union, who supported the workers' case, about what this means for Aotearoa's employment law and protecting the rights of our workers. Kia ora, Anita. Could you please provide a recap of the employment misclassification case that the four Uber drivers first took to court in 2021?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like you say, back in 2021, there were two unions, so ETU and Workers First Union, that's the union I work for, which was just called First Union at the time. We backed four Uber drivers who wanted to take the company to court to basically test their employment status. So Uber was saying, you're not employees, you don't have any rights, you don't have any protections, and that means that, you know, they were earning less than minimum wage, they didn't have any leave, they didn't have any right to challenge an unfair dismissal or anything like that, and it was a very frustrating experience for them. And they had also gone into it, like, really buying into, or I mean, just believing the company's advertising, I guess, that they were going to be their own boss and they were going to make, like, the advertising at the time, I think, said, you know, $33 an hour and all this kind of thing. And then they kind of, like, realised, oh, that's not actually what this is. They still have a great level of control over my work. They're still telling me what I should and shouldn't do. And the pay is just absolutely abysmal. So they wanted to test that, and the way you do that is you go to the employment court, and the employment court looks at what is the nature of this relationship between the company and the workers, who actually, you know, in practice, not just what the contract says, because obviously with a contract, you know, your boss could write whatever they wanted in it, and if you don't have any power when you go to sign that document, you're not going to have any say over what it says. So they take into account what's in writing, but they also look at what happens in practice, and does it align and that kind of thing. And so the employment court in 2022 released its judgment that it believed that the workers were actually employees, not contractors or anything else. So then that obviously meant that, technically speaking, they were entitled to all the rights and protections under, like, the Employment Relations Act and the Holidays Act. I mean, they had the right to unionise and collectively bargain and all that kind of thing. And so at that point, we initiated collective bargaining with the company, and we also started submitting claims for back pay, wage arrears, for not just those four drivers, but for, like, any driver that came along and joined our union and wanted us to do it. And so to date, we've submitted more than 1,000 of those claims, and the authority's been totally inundated with that. But what's been happening alongside that is Uber, of course, as you'd expect, had appealed that decision. So they said, we don't agree with it, we want to take it to the Court of Appeal, and they were granted the right to do that. And then obviously all of what we were doing off the back of that win was put on hold. So the authority said, let's wait and see what the Court of Appeal said. And then the Court of Appeal considered it, and they were like, no, we agree with the employment court, these workers are actually employees. And that ruling came out last year. And then Uber's response to that, of course, was, okay, we're going to take this to the Supreme Court. And the good news is that the Supreme Court is where it ends, right? They can't go any further than that. So it was really important for us. Like, the stakes were really high that we had a positive judgment out of the Supreme Court, because if you lose in the Supreme Court, then there's nowhere to go. And we felt confident because we won in the two lower courts, obviously. But you never really know, like, these things can be overturned at the Supreme level. So we were absolutely stoked when we found out on Monday this week that the Supreme Court had also ruled in our favour. So the Supreme Court is a panel of judges rather than just one judge. There were five judges involved, and all five judges voted unanimously that the workers were employees. So it's, like, the strongest outcome you could hope for out of the Supreme Court. So we're absolutely stoked.
And what does this win signal for contract workers in similar industries and ones adjacent to drivers?
I think, first of all, the judgment, strictly speaking, applies to the four drivers. But there's also some commentary in the judgments over the years that have sort of said, well, the system that Uber drivers work under is very uniform. So although they can't rule on anyone else in particular, they can say that, like, you know, the system doesn't really distinguish between drivers, so it probably means that they're all employees. And our view is that they absolutely are all employees. So that's what we're kind of acting on the basis of. And then you've got a proliferation of other companies that have basically just replicated Uber's model, so other rideshare companies, gig work operators. And so you could kind of, like, extend that logic. You could say all of these companies are misclassifying their workers. They all should be employees. But the fact of the matter is, like, unless the company just turns around and decides to do the right thing one day, which we all know they're not going to do that, there's, like, an onus on the workers to actually take a case to court to test their employment status, which is a massive, massive piece of work. So you know, whether or not there will be any massive changes for those other companies that have sort of copied Uber remains to be seen. But Uber is about 90%+ of the market. I think they have an overwhelming amount of market share. It really is a monopoly with like a couple of tiny players tacked on the side. So even if Uber is the only company that changes as a result of this, it really is changing the whole gig economy in New Zealand because they're just such a big player. And then also in terms of making change in the industry, like they're a leader, obviously, in terms of what they do, and then the other companies just copy. So we're really hoping that it will have a positive effect on those other drivers engaged in the gig economy because it is just like they were sold all these fantasies, right, of like be your own boss, make all this money. And what it has turned into is just like a really dystopic kind of servitude. And I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised, but I think a lot of people were drawn in really genuinely hoping that this was going to be a better way of life for them. And it hasn't turned out that way. And then in terms of like other contractors and other parts of the economy, there's obviously a lot of genuine contractors out there, and that doesn't concern us. That's not where the issues lie. It's really with the workers who aren't genuine contractors, and because of that, it's their employers are only doing it to save on costs associated with minimum standards, so minimum wage and forms of leave and that kind of thing. So if you're like an IT consultant and you're a contractor, but you're technically only working for one company, you're full-time for that company, you know, it may be the case that you're not technically, under the eyes of the law, not technically a contractor. If it were tested in court, they might say, you're really an employee. But say you're earning like, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, you probably don't really care, and they probably don't really care that much. So no one's going to take it to court, you know. There's just no real interest to take that to court. It's really where we've got workers who are absolutely being ripped off, losing out. And we see a lot of that. Even in the construction industry, we've got apprentices who are being told you're a contractor. And like, remember that a contractor is also meant to be a business person. And these are kids who've left school, don't know how to build yet, and they're being told, oh, you're actually the owner of a business. You're the owner of a building company, even though you don't know how to build. So the degree to which like employers have taken this misclassification in our economy is just so ridiculous. Like, it's been stretched as far as it can possibly be stretched, and it's about time we rein it back in again.
Uber had some input into drafting the Employment Relations Amendment Bill that is currently being pushed through Parliament. How concerning is that influence?
Massively concerning, yeah. So they Uber met with Minister Brooke Van Velden on May Day, no less, while workers were in the streets, you know, chanting for better rights and protections. And she just agreed, just rolled over and agreed to advance this legislation that they'd put together, which would potentially put a stop to any challenge against them by their workers in the future. Yeah, it's very concerning. And I think it also doesn't make any sense when you look at, on the one hand, you've got tens of thousands of New Zealanders who've either driven for this, are driving for this company or have driven for this company in the past and been ripped off. And then the other hand, you have a global multi-billion dollar corporation out of Silicon Valley that doesn't even pay anywhere near what it owes in its taxes in New Zealand and claims that it's not a transport company in New Zealand and claims that it doesn't have any employees here. I genuinely don't understand why any political party would put the interests of that organisation over the tens of thousands of workers who have driven for them.
Where to from here for holding that? Where to from here for holding these dynamics to account?
I think that we need to put as much pressure as we possibly can on this government to kill the bill that they have advanced on behalf of Uber. I think it goes deeper than that, though, and we need to hold them account on all of the ways in which they've been influenced by various corporate interests over their time in power. And, I mean, next year's an election year. Like, that's the ultimate opportunity for accountability for this government, right? I mean, I haven't seen anything from them that gives me kind of confidence that they're going to be doing the right thing by workers if they get another term. So I would say vote them out. Vote them out not just on this, but vote them out on their massive betrayal of working women with the throwing out of equal pay cases. You know, vote them out on all of the changes that they've made that have negatively impacted regular working New Zealanders through economic change and basically just making false promises that they were going to turn things around and improve things for us, and we've seen the opposite of that.
That was Deputy Secretary of Workers First Union Anita Rosentrader on the historic four-year legal battle on employment rights that four Kiwi drivers have won against Uber.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki wā'o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for our Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, Save the Children's Vera Packey, and Workers First Anita Rosentrater. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up shortly is the 1-4 with Sophia.
Thank you. That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.